Tim here with a message before the podcast. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from Royal Blood's self-titled debut album. All tracks are written by Mike Kerr and Ben Thatcher. Royal Blood was released on the 25th of August, 2014 on Warner Brothers. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Where real music matters.
Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.
Hiya, I'm Tim Burgess and welcome to another episode of Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. If it's your first time listening, this is a show where I sit down with an artist going through a classic album and hearing the stories behind it. I've had loads of fascinating chats so far with guests from Kings of Leon and The Police to Bon Jovi and Sparks. To catch up on any of these episodes, just search for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts to discover a whole archive of past listening parties. Just like Tim's Twitter listening party, a huge part of this is your involvement, so please get involved on social media throughout the show using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party and check out at Tim_Burgess and at Absolute Radio on X for more listening party content. This episode I'm joined by Mike Kerr and Ben Thatcher from Royal Blood to talk about their self-titled debut on its 10th anniversary. A number one album in the UK, it was one of the fastest selling rock debuts of the decade, going double platinum. It led to the band receiving the Brit Award for the Best British Band in 2015, as well as a Mercury Prize nomination. When you hear a Royal Blood song, it takes some believing that this noise is made by just two people, bass and drums, which is why their eponymous debut led to Royal Blood being heralded as the saviours of rock and roll. You can hear a very special 10-year anniversary edition of the album right now. Since the debut, they've released three more albums that all hit the top of the UK charts and have supported the likes of Arctic Monkeys, Foo Fighters, Queens of the Stone Age and Muse over the past decade. They now sell out arena tours and headline festivals worldwide by themselves. Okay. Ben?
Yes.
Mike?
It's a good start.
From me or from you?
No, for you, because we're a bit like Ant and Dec. You got to... It's a 50-50 chance of getting it.
Yeah,
catastrophic. Everyone's name in the band wrong.
Right, right, yeah.
Okay. Like Penn and Teller.
Yeah, I know them. Actually.
Tim.
They're good lads.
Tim, we got, yeah.
Yeah, it's easy for us.
Yeah, okay. So, we're here to talk about Royal Blood.
Yes.
And I was very pleased to learn that it was recorded in Rockfield. Can you tell me about your experience there?
Yeah, Rockfield's the studio that we'd been to a few times before we'd kind of formally formed the band. I think the first time we met there, we were essentially kind of playing on someone else's record as session musicians. Ben had actually got me the gig because they needed a bass player.
And who was this for?
A mystery artist.
A mystery artist, okay.
Yeah. I hadn't really played bass at all. But Ben kind of got me the gig because it was, he reckoned that I could blag it. So that was the first time we went. And we actually met.
Was this the Coach House or the Quadrangle?
I think we did a bit in both.
Yeah.
I think we went on two separate occasions and sort of did one in each. We actually met Tom Dalgetty, the producer, on those sessions.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So, so when it came round to recording Royal Blood, it was a kind of like we'd been there and loved it.
Familiarity.
Yeah, and we'd worked with Tom and got on really well. So that's really the origin of why we ended up there and with Tom.
So was Tom involved in the mystery project as well?
He was, yeah. And in between those sessions, we formed a good relationship with Tom. And I would, even though I didn't have a band at the time, I wanted to keep writing my own music. And so I kind of forged a good relationship with him by kind of making demos in his house. So he was very much in the club from kind of early doors.
And where were the demos kind of conceived or the tracks conceived?
Some of them started in Bath where he lives.
Right, okay.
But really, we didn't make any demos really for the band. It was by the time Ben and I were kind of playing, we were writing songs live at Brighton Electric Studios. And the first time we recorded them are the final versions that you hear.
Do you think it's as good as it's cracked up to be, Rockfield? I mean, it's such a long way from Brighton.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I think if you're a live band, you know, the thing you're really getting back from Rockfield is the drum room. That's the thing, right?
yeah, you just feel like a part of something when you're there.
I agree.
There's, you know, the history of the place and being the oldest residential studio in the world is pretty insane. And, yeah, I think just the vibe of staying there and getting your head down. There's nothing really going on too much in Monmouth. There is a Pizza Express there now, though, which could be dangerous for artists.
It's a good Waitrose.
There's a good Waitrose, yeah. But other than that, yeah, you just get your head down and you enjoy the vibe of the studio. And, yeah, like Mike said, great drum room. And there's varieties of rooms in at Rockfield that you can go and experiment in. There's the echo chambers and...
Yeah.
You can really focus when you're there because it's residential and because, like Ben was saying, because you're cut off from everything else, you really feel like you can zero in on what you're doing.
And you only have Kingsley to hang out with.
Yeah, Kingsley.
Legendary.
Yeah. Actually, the last time we were there not too long ago,
right,
and we were there for a birth of a lamb called Snowy.
I have met Snowy.
Have you?
I have. Yeah, I had my photographs taken with all of the lambs stroke now sheep.
Wow. Know?
So Ben was responsible for...
They mentioned it, actually. I think Lisa mentioned it.
Yeah, what did you... You actually
built Snowy's
shelter.
Yeah.
Ahead of the birth.
Yeah, I did I finished my drums and then I went and focused in on other projects.
You're a sort of farmhand now.
Yeah.
That's a good side project, right?
It is, yeah. It's quite traumatic. There was a moment we had to get one of the doctors, the animal doctors. And,
the lamb doctor.
Lamb doctor, yeah.
Come that's the next come album. Help out. Lamb doctor. It's just him on the front with the... Yeah.
But yeah, amazing.
It's all going on at Rockfield.
And I got a nice photograph of me with the lambs. And Snowy was down at the front telling me stories about royal blood.
Yeah.
Okay, let's kick off this listening party with the first track from your debut. It's Out of the Black. That was Out of the Black by Royal Blood, the first song from their self-titled debut album. It's Tim Burgess here having a listening party with Mike Kerr and Ben Thatcher on Absolute Radio, going through that very album. Can you tell me about that first track, please?
Out of the Black started as an idea in the pub together, and I started tapping on a table.
Yeah.
Just that rhythm. I think Mike was like, yeah, that's really cool, remember that. And then we got into a studio, into a writing space, and started hashing out ideas around it.
Yeah,
that song in hindsight came kind of in the middle of the writing process.
Okay.
It came with a couple of songs that later on the album, like Loose Change. That song Loose Change and Out of the Black, we kind of were writing at the same time, and at one point in the process were the same song.
Right, yeah.
Different sections. And then the outro of Out the Black was something that we had written years ago, before it was called Royal Blood.
I think a lot of the way we wrote songs on that first record is we wrote sections of songs almost like puzzle pieces. So we were like banking parts, what felt like parts of songs.
Yeah.
Some of them, you know, it was very clear which parts were meant to go together, but others we had these kind of parts floating around.
Yeah,
so kind of like Ben was saying, the chorus of Out of the Black, at one point we were trying to put with the verse of Loose Change, and then we eventually decided that they didn't belong together, and the end of Out of the Black was this thing that was just we had together that was just floating around.
Yeah.
We thought that would be a great way to end a song.
Brilliant.
But we don't have a song to end.
Yeah.
So it Out of the Black is really like this Frankenstein of like ideas that all needed a home and kind of stitched together and made this kind of like really long, this really long thing. It was like we kept being like, oh, then we could put this bit on, and yeah, it kind of accumulated. So yeah, like Ben was saying, it was kind of the middle of the process, and that's really what that song is.
Middle of the process, but then, you know, putting it at the start of the album, was that, you know, was it just really obvious to you?
I just think that sometimes, like, the simplest way of thinking about how to start a record and how to end a record is what song has the best beginning.
Yeah.
And to us, that felt like the strongest, our strongest kind of opening out of all the tracks on the record.
It's really powerful.
Yeah, and I think when it became clear as well that that was the first song we were going to put out, I don't know, that I liked the marriage of it being the opening track on the record and the first time you hear us, you know, so I think that's why it's there.
And, like, you know, the lyrics, and how, you know, how do you go about all that?
I'd basically just kind of blurt out absolute nonsense in the rehearsal space, making noises and fun.
Recording as well? Or
maybe like on an iPhone, filming ourselves, but kind of just like finding like where I was going to go with my voice.
Yeah.
And I still really do this now, honestly. I would then transpose whatever I did in that process to an acoustic or a piano and kind of figure out what the bones of the song is underneath what we're playing. And kind of hash out lyrics there.
So when you're blurting out, do you like mishear things and think that that's a good thing?
Exactly. You say like words and things, and I'd kind of form it. The majority of the vocals are really written like that.
Yeah.
Sometimes I would save a lot of writing room for when we got to Rockfield.
Right. Wow.
Which I refuse to do anymore because it's just too much pressure. It's too stressful. But there was many evenings sort of pacing up and down the field.
being inspired by snowing.
I mean, sometimes
teacher snowing.
Sometimes that level of pressure is a good thing. But yeah, there would sort of be like two separate processes to forming some of the songs.
It would always start
with the energy of what Ben and I were playing, and then if it felt exciting enough, then I'd kind of delve into the hard work of kind of of writing lyrics. Yeah,
it's hard writing lyrics in a studio, especially when it. Somewhere as remote as Rockfield, and you know, I'm saying that with experience.
Yeah, because you're being pushed by time restraints, perhaps over inspiration.
Yeah, and you're in a spot where you probably wouldn't be as inspired as maybe in a day-to-day living.
Yeah, it's paid off sometimes, but yeah.
Right, that's good. Let's say the second track from Raw Blood. This is Come On Over. Last track was called Come On Over. Where was this recorded?
We recorded this in Narm, I think, right? In Bradford and Avon.
Yeah.
Which was close enough to Rockfield, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So you brought parts to Rockfield, perhaps?
Yeah, that was a song we had sort of fully formed.
Yeah.
That was probably one of the first things we kind of went through when Ben and I got together and started playing.
Yeah.
I don't like fully remember how a lot of...
I remember you had the bones to the song. I think you had a recorded version of you doing it.
Yeah, I think I'd done a demo with Tom, yeah.
It was just in the first batch of songs to record. It was one of the first. It's pretty straightforward, really, I think, that one. We knew what it was doing and we thought it sounded great. It was a quite short, little nifty song.
Yeah.
I think we were so kind of well-rehearsed because... Before going into the studio, we weren't kind of like crafting songs in the studio. It was really a case of like pointing mics at what we were doing in the rehearsal space.
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, Ben would do his drums in like the first or the second take.
Do you use elements of both takes or the three takes?
Yeah, we patch it together.
Patch it together and then...
get the
And in this instance,
you did
brought
your
something.
Takes. I remember you did. We wouldn't do more than three takes.
No, yeah. No.
We were like, why would you want to do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was. But that was because we were so we had played it so many times.
You were doing them in one, and I was doing them in like three.
Yeah.
I probably should have done more listening back. But,
well, no.
Or not. Yeah. I don't know. We're here talking about it. So.
I don't know whether this has been said before, but if it has, please forgive me. I guess technically you're the world's biggest drum and bass band.
Yeah.
Are we though?
Don't know. I mean,
that's going on.
Things have changed. Things have changed.
You
know, things move pretty fast these days, you know. But
can we use that
on the next like tour poster?
Yeah. I hope you don't want to, but if you do, yeah, feel free. Yeah. I mean, I suppose a lot's been talked about just being, you know, bass and drums, and especially with this album. When you came out, did you think of it conceptually, or was it something, you know, you said that you got together and, you know, minimum sort of like force and everything like that with the sound? And
yeah, I think we really became passionate about
this way of thinking. Yeah.
And we still are honestly passionate about performing live.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that being the kind of the reason why we make records. And I think we liked the idea of limitation, and I think we had a good understanding actually of how limitation is, how beneficial that is to creativity.
Yeah.
You know, we're big fans of everything Jack White was doing, and we still are of what he does. And I think the way he had kind of talked about it before, it really resonated with me.
Yeah.
And yeah, we just kind of, despite being in bands with more members before, it became more exciting and more interesting and more creative to us to have these kind of brutal restrictions. And I think it served us massively.
Yeah, great.
It kind of, I think what we've noticed from, you know, being in a two-piece this long is that, you know, just because something's simpler doesn't mean it's easier, you know. And in fact, the more we took away, the more... You know, the fewer pillars you have, the more pressure is on those pillars.
Yeah.
So I think when it was like, okay, we need a drum part, we need a bass part and a vocal part.
Yeah.
And we realized, oh my God, like all three of those things need to be really good.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to hide. And I think we still enjoy that kind of, that pressure, you know, and that just chasing chaff, basically. We're chaff chasers.
Chaff chasers, yeah. Okay, so I guess a great example of this is track 3 on the album. It's a classic, Figure It Out. Tell me about the song we just heard, Figure It Out.
Yeah.
Big song.
Yeah, that was just kind of, that was like the first thing we recorded, maybe. Yeah. It was definitely in that session. Yeah, that was just kind of always electric to play together in these, you know, small rooms.
And, yeah, yeah.
We performed.
What were
that.
The kind of rooms that you were playing?
We played a small bar in Worthing called Tangerine.
Tangerine.
Which actually technically was an open mic night.
That just was our the drum kit in.
Great. That was our debut. Yeah. And
great. Imagine the people that were there, though, and sort of like, you know, their story.
Yeah. I remember I don't think I had lyrics for that song.
Right.
I think because we were playing open mic nights, my vocal was going through, you know, a tiny PA, and I had this wall of amps. So, like, the vocal was like so, it was like so buried under what we were doing. I could get away with kind of doing what I was doing in the rehearsal room, which was just kind of like making nonsensical noises, which is probably, I think that's actually why Figure It Out probably ended up being the sort of song title, because, you know, it was like I would sort of blurt something and be like, oh, I'll work it out later.
Work it out later, yeah. Very good. I guess, you know, this kind of gave you the label of saviours of British rock. How did that make you feel? And, you know, where do you go from there, you know?
It didn't really make me feel much, I have to say.
Yeah.
It was a couple of words that I didn't really believe, because I didn't believe rock needed saving.
Yeah.
I've always listened to it. I've always enjoyed playing it.
Yeah.
I think the time that we came out, there might have been a little bit of a lull in rock and roll.
Yeah.
But being a saviour of anything is a strange thing to think about.
Yeah, we were just playing music that we grew up loving and felt so inspired by, that we felt the need to kind of be a part of it, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we just felt like we were kind of adding to the rich tapestry of rock and roll. It didn't feel like we were kind of, like Ben said, it didn't feel like we were resurrecting anything or kind of operating on anything.
I also think that it's the only genre of music that people really have this thing about it dying.
Yeah.
You don't go, the death of reggae. Jazz is dead.
It's always been kind of another great album title, but it's always being analysed, isn't it?
The saviours of rap music.
It's always having kind of fingers put up to its pulse and,
yeah,
and being checked on constantly.
I think rock music needs to have a pause for something else to come along. And like you said, there was a gap maybe for something, you know, new to grow.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Well, we had just come out of kind of the indie new metal kind of stage.
Yeah.
Where rock can get a bit stinky at some stages. There's a fine line between stink and lovely smelling flowers.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Or a blend of...
It's a tightrope, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike.
A blend of rawness that can, you know, turn it into something new.
Yeah. But also, I think that rock music can have this, like, Metallica, kind of, like, thing going on with it. But it also can be really soft.
Yeah.
It can also have, like, we're massive fans of Queens of the Stone Age. And Josh does not have that vocal in him.
He's a great singer.
He's a great singer. But he doesn't use that, like, harsh rock, typical rock vocal, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I lost at poker with Josh.
You lost?
I lost, yeah. I mean, I wasn't really taking it that seriously, and I should have, but it was at his house as well, so...
What did
I
you
felt
lose?
Like I needed to, you know, sort of, like, pay, you know, just be respectful. Yeah. And not sort of, like, you know...
Can't be a sore loser,
charging,
yeah.
Winning your cards and...
Flip the table.
This is Royal Blood with You Can Be So Cruel on Absolute Radio. You Can Be So Cruel.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
You Can Be So Cruel.
How dare you? How dare you? It's true, though. It is true. That was also in that demo session. I think what happened with some of those recordings is when it came to having some budget to go to Rockfield to kind of record like what would be the second half of the record.
Yeah.
I think we might have gone back in and, like, I think I redid the vocal for that track, Brighton Electric. We sort of went in, but most of the stuff we did there, we did attempt to kind of, like, touch up and kind of improve, but we ended up making it worse, so we reverted.
This was at Rockfield or Brighton?
In Brighton,
Okay, yeah.
But yeah, that song is, except for the vocal, I think everything else we did.
That happens along the way of making an album, doesn't it? It's like, you know, you start off with something and you think, let's do it again.
Yeah, I think sometimes if something's easy or quick, there's a worry that you didn't do it right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes you need to feel like you worked for it to get it to a good place.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of, you know, having done a few records now, you kind of realize actually it's the other way around. You know, it's usually the thing you lay down without thinking about it, and that is the take, or when you actually captured something that was special.
Yeah,
it's sitting there and doing it over and over again isn't usually the answer.
Yeah,
But I think that's why particularly your first record and the first half of this record, you know, is we kind of just like bashed out the recordings because, like Ben said, we thought they were demos and there was a kind of carefree attitude to it all.
There is that feeling when you're making a demo that it's like, you know, you're gonna improve on it later down the road. And,
yeah.
So there's no need to get it, you know, right.
Yeah, but it just means you get a kind of relaxed, carefree performance, which is in this genre is what it's really all about.
Yeah,
it's
definitely
about the imperfections and about that vibe.
Yeah. The next song is Blood Hands. Is that in 3/4? Is it?
I don't know. Ben,
7/8?
Six. Six, 12, 9. It has that feel to it. Yeah,
I never knew that. Is it in 6/8? That's terrible.
I don't know what it is.
I thought it was just.
I'm not a drummer. It is swingy.
It's very swingy.
But it is. Yeah. Do 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 do.
No, it's great. I like that a lot. And then it straightens out a bit. In the chorus.
Yeah. But it's still that time signature.
Yeah, it's still not a 4/4, is it?
No, yeah.
It's swingy. It all really centres around, that kind of groove, really.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And a lot of the kind of writing process for this record was, kind of starting with a kind of, a feel.
Yeah.
I think we were so, the biggest concern we had about making a whole record of just being in a two-piece was everything sounding the same, you know?
Yeah.
It was making sure things sounded varied. So whether it was my guitar tones or whether it was even the key signature, like not hearing the same key every song after. So it's like another kind of tool we were kind of using was making sure that, you know, things had a kind of rhythmical variation. Ben was always kind of like, we need something that...
I mean, that's
what
definitely one,
got?
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Good shift.
And actually, You Can Be So Cruel before it had that as well. We're kind of thinking, you know, making sure that every track had its own kind of, groove to it. So they could...
Like an identity.
Yeah. So I don't remember much about it other than it was kind of written around that feel and that groove. And
I think the last riff of it is my favourite part of the album, I think.
That's still one of my favourite parts to play live.
It's so good.
I like that one a lot.
Yeah.
Well done.
Well done you.
Okay, let's hear Blood Hands. Blood Hands by Royal Blood on Absolute Radio. So it's the 10th anniversary. Do you think the audience is the same but older, or is it all like just new people just, you know, tuning in?
It's like a mixture, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's a whole mixture.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the last 10 years we've really built quite a crazy fan base.
Yeah.
And it's... I would say at the beginning there was a lot of older males coming to the shows And then it kind of just adapted. I think being played on different radio stations and being involved at the Brit Awards and things like that, all things that we didn't really expect to happen, brought in a lot of varied people.
Yeah, of course.
And, since then we've, you know, written three other albums since the beginning. So the fan base has just grown, played different festivals, and you know how it goes. It's just... But I think, with the first one, we couldn't believe that people were there to see us or listen to us.
One of my questions would be, certainly, like, you know, can you sort of, like, describe the lay of the land before you kind of, like, discovered that you had this album or that we discovered that you had this album?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very quick trajectory that obviously has a backstory of Ben and I playing together for years and you know...
Yeah.
In multiple, you know, different ways. But I think the minute we started the band, we were straight into writing. And as much as we wanted to play lots of shows, it was proving quite difficult, and it's difficult to get shows.
And we
felt like our efforts were better spent on getting more material together. Because there was a few times where we did a few shows, but we had like 3 or 4 songs.
Right, yeah.
So we felt so obviously limited by default as to what we could do.
Did you play them multiple times?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So there was an urgency to go and really go and write music. So we spent a lot of time doing that. And the minute we had a sort of set's worth of material, we just sort of hit the road and played, basically just went around the UK a couple of times. But it didn't take long for things to change very quickly. And it felt like we weren't skipping gears, but we were like busting through them quickly. And it felt like every time we did a tour, it was just slowly getting bigger and we were doing something new for the first time.
So the timing was just like perfect.
Yeah.
Well, at the beginning, as we started the band, we went to Rockfield to, it was demos. We were going to demo three or four songs with Tom, and we were doing it in between Christmas and New Year.
Nice.
Because it was the cheapest time to get the studio.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're all around at that time. After that, I think Mike, you put out one of the songs on like a MySpace page, or was it SoundCloud?
Yeah.
One of those platforms.
I was like, wait till this goes online, and then there was about 30 people listened to it in about a month, and I was like, oh.
But then we met a guy called Phil Christie, who he was working at Warner Chappell. He was doing the publishing there.
Yeah.
He was like, have you guys heard about publishing? And we were like, no, we have no idea what's going on. And anyway, that evolved, and we ended up taking down those songs from MySpace or whatever it was.
Were they advising you to take them down because, like, you know...
They were like, they're really good.
On
yeah, I think they saw...
Royalties and stuff.
They saw
they
things...
They were like, they're really good, but your haircuts are terrible.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
No.
No. just joking.
But I think he just saw potential in us. And
great, yeah.
He enjoyed the songs and kind of invested in us. Yeah. And we started then, not knowingly, but writing the first album.
Yeah, okay.
We were writing 3 songs like at Brighton Electric, and then going to Tom Dalgetty at Rockfield or in this other studio called NAM, which was in just outside of Bath.
Bradford on Avon.
Thank you.
Right.
And then just recording them.
Yeah.
And then, we went back to like try and re-record some of the demos, and just didn't work. Didn't have the magic.
I understand that.
And so, what you're hearing on that first record is the birth of Royal Blood.
Yeah.
And, at its rawest.
Did you have, like, quite a lot of say in the production and,
Absolutely, kind of like, Yeah. I mean, like, we were kind of leading the way, really, on it.
Yeah.
But, the way that record sounds, a lot of credit really is due to Tom because...
Yeah. Guidance.
It seems to be when the three of us to get together, that kind of sound just seems to come out of the speakers, and the way he records the drums and the way he puts it together. And I think as well, he's in absolute agreement with us in how things should be. It always feels like we're going in the same direction,
Do you need that kind of like, are you kind of opposing at times or?
No, so, we're kind of on the same team. And if we ever have something we're in disagreement about, we come to the conclusion that it's wrong.
Right, yeah.
Not that one of us is right. Yeah. We're like, that means the idea isn't right.
That's interesting.
Because the whole thing is about chemistry and the dynamic. Yeah. That's actually all we have as
so,
a two-piece.
Yeah, so
it's
don't
how
need
we bounce kind of, off each other, yeah. Right. Yeah. So if we're not having that feeling, then we happily discard it.
Yes, that's great. So, guys, the next song on your debut is a classic, Little Monster.
Yes.
And that's...
That starts side B, if you're on a vinyl.
If you're on the vinyl, yeah. And that would that be... I know it's a big song, but was it a single?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was.
I don't remember. Was it a single?
We made, like, 3 music videos for it. One was really expensive and...
As it
And we never
is.
Actually saw it. And so we actually then panicked.
Right.
And did a live video for it.
That's a good video, that.
Libby. Yeah, Libby was on that one. And that was done in Sheffield at the Lead Mill.
Oh, yeah.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you remember about Little Monster?
Little Monster.
I think we wrote that at Brighton Electric.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't...
Do you remember much?
No.
I remember your drum fill being a good moment.
Yeah.
Where we were like, what if the whole song stopped just so you could do a drum fill?
Yeah.
Which is what every song should have.
Yeah. We were like, what if everyone in the band stopped?
Yeah.
Just to hear a drum fill.
I think that was your idea, not mine.
I think it was my idea for you to do a drum fill, but you came up with the drum fill.
Okay.
I think that's the truth of it.
Okay.
I think it was a Tame Impala thing. I think I noticed that a lot of the time, you know, everything would cut out and then he'd have like a really phasey drum fill.
Yeah.
Nice.
And I was like, we should do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we did a terrible job of imitating. Little Monster is us trying to sound like Tame Impala.
Well, that's good. That's good. I'll go down well. Time to hear it. This is Little Monster by Royal Blood. Track number 6 on Royal Blood, that was Little Monster. The second track on side 2.
Loose Change.
That's the one. 2 minutes 35.
Yeah. This song, as we said earlier, was joined at the same time as Out the Black. It kind of had this more hip-hoppy feel to this one.
That's really, I would say that, like, that drumming style on Loose Change is really like your world. Like, that's your kind of, like, more... Yeah. That's more of your sort of default position on the drums, I would say.
Yeah, groove-based.
Groove-based and kind of... I don't know, had a kind of swag to it.
Yeah.
And because you're kind of playing in that way, that there was, like, there's a lot of, like, headroom in the song. Sometimes when the drums are, like, so, like, cymbal-heavy and bombastic, it's, like, it can be, like, a battle. Whereas Loose Change felt, like, so controlled and kind of... narrow, that it just had this kind of space for the song, but then also like how it kind of ends, we can kind of go into a more kind of rock thing, and it had room to go and do that. So it was a fun one to do.
Did he say hip hop a minute ago?
I think you might have said it.
Yeah, more of that groove, like hip hoppy groove.
Yeah,
but I remember trying to write a chorus for this one. I think Nothing was really landing with what the feel of the song. Mm-hmm. And so we were just working out how to construct it and almost have an anti-chorus and just a tagline. And
we definitely tried, like shoehorning in. But then I think that was coming from a place of like songs should. It came from shoulds.
Yeah.
Things should have this, should have this. And then I think we kind of reference like Come Together, where we realise, actually, things can just do a U-turn on themselves and come back in a satisfying way without having a proper chorus. And I think the ending of the song felt like a kind of payoff anyway. But yeah, we definitely spent like quite a long time trying to write a chorus for it that it didn't
need.
Maybe it did need, but I don't think it did.
No.
I think the way you wanted to record the drums as well was like, you know, kind of much more like making it sound like a hip-hop thing as well.
Yeah.
Like, very, like, dead and doing the cymbals kind of separately and getting it as, like... That, I think, like, Loose Change sounds the most different from anything else on the record. It's probably the departure, actually. It's kind of a left turn.
It's also, like we were saying earlier, there's a different beat, a different flavour to the record.
Mm-hmm.
There was somewhere else to go. Yeah, I think we've gone there a few times in the future. Yeah. I think it was just the start of that moment.
That gear.
All right, this is Loose Change on Absolute Radio. That's Loose Change from Warblood's eponymous debut release, and that was from 2014. Mike, I wanted to ask you, surely that's a guitar at the beginning of Careless.
Well, a bass is a guitar, isn't it? Let's get that cleared up.
A bass is a guitar.
It's a piece of wood with wire on it.
I was going to ask, use five string basses or even Fender 6?
Not in public.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
You've got to keep some things shrouded.
I've got good friends that are honest to my face, you know. Better get stabbed in the face and in the back.
Fender 6?
No, it's the kind of Gretsch short scale I was using, but I just put on two guitar strings. So it's two bass strings, two guitar strings.
Wow.
As I started on piano, I always think about it from the perspective of sitting at a piano. So to me, the bass, playing the bass was both my hands were at the bottom half of the piano, and Careless meant my right hand could come up, so they could be equal distance apart, you know. So it felt like I had a more extreme seesaw. And I think we were talking about earlier about variation and in whatever way possible, I think I knew that if I'd kind of put a bass together that would confuse me and be its own thing, surely a song of its own kind would kind of come out of it. And I still do that now. There's still
has anyone done it before?
Probably, yeah. Probably. I don't think I invented anything there.
Is that new tuning or something?
Yeah. I still don't remember what the tuning is.
I thought all of the strings were the same tuning.
That is another thing I've done. I do sometimes.
Giving it all away.
Yeah, giving away my secrets, man.
Well, we like to
do something else now.
Like to get under the bonnet of the car.
Yeah,
if you've got an electric car, there's nothing there. But see how the engine works.
Well, it doesn't.
No, not an electric car.
It's broken. There is an engine there, but it's it needs a bit of work.
It's confused.
So Careless then being track 8, and you know you mentioned that track 9 and 10 were the last two written for the album.
Yeah.
Was Careless the one just before that?
Yeah. No, the Careless came during the Little Monster kind of era, in the middle somewhere.
Yeah, in the middle somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Funnily enough though, this song we stopped playing live. It was the only one we stopped playing.
Why did we stop playing it?
I don't know. We started playing Hole instead.
Is it because Hole's easier?
Maybe, yeah.
We just did these 10-year anniversary shows where we played the first record kind of in order.
Yeah.
And I was playing Careless thinking, this is hard now. So what chance did I have back then?
Yeah. It was 9 or 8 years since we had played that song.
Yeah.
Until this year.
How is it for you? Easy?
I loved it.
Easy, yeah. Easy one for you to play?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably the easiest.
I don't think I've ever played it without making a mistake of some kind, which isn't great. I shouldn't really be playing it, really.
And what about
kind of statistic?
How did it make you feel?
Nervous.
What, to play it live?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, just while you were playing it.
That fourth drumstick click, I'd be
I was fine.
I'm not sure if I can do this.
I think we stopped playing it during the second record because there was another song called Hook, Line, Sinker that might have used that bass.
Ah, that's it. Yeah. You've cracked the code.
Thank you.
Okay. We tried to get two songs out of the same bass.
Yeah.
And they're in different tunings to the extreme where it wasn't a case of just retuning it because some of the strings would just snap. So we had to
choose one or the other.
Make a decision. I feel like that was the right choice. That
yeah.
We shouldn't be slagging our songs off this record, really.
No, oh, definitely not.
I if mean, we were.
Let's hear another track from the album, The Eighth. This is Careless by Royal Blood. Could you tell there was some momentum, you know, or was it just, or were you just like just doing what you, you know, you feel that you'd been doing
in the creative process?
Yeah, in the creative process and in the way that things were going, was it, you know, obviously you'd met this guy from Warner's.
Yeah, I think it was. It felt like, particularly from our friendship group.
Yeah,
it felt like there was a shared feeling between Ben and I and our mates, yeah, of like we had landed on something that was special.
Yeah, that's the most amazing thing, right?
Yeah, we had friends come up to us going, you two guys doing the whatever this is,
yeah,
you should, this is good, you should,
yeah,
you should invest time in this, this is, yeah, exciting. As kind of unready as it was.
Yeah,
and kind of, yeah, it was
sometimes when it's too ready though, it's like,
yeah, it was, we needed to like put more time into writing and playing together and stuff, but I think they could see early on that we had something. And I think that, above all else, that was the thing that made me kind of feel like we had something, yeah, special. Because these were also people we'd been in bands with before.
Yeah, so it was...
And trusted.
You'd been in like four pieces and three-piece bands.
Yeah.
With the idea of like two, I mean, the jokey side of me would say, was there any financial consideration, you know, the two of you being in a band, just the two, you know, was it twin rooms, crashing at fans' house, sharing a car?
I mean, all of those things were handy.
Yeah.
But not a consideration.
If making money is the sort of drive of starting a band, yeah, you're in the wrong.
Or being able to
avenue.
Share a room together. But
we should have gone into the stock market or something.
But yeah, good. those things are handy at points.
Yeah.
Of course. And also, even like band practices, you know.
Yeah, more room.
It was getting everyone together.
Yeah.
When you have four people...
E3 Thursday.
Yeah.
Everyone's in. But I think just as many cons come as pros, it just sort of... However big or small your band is, you kind of... It's really about how it works together.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, that, you know, being in a two-piece wasn't something we really set out to do.
Yeah.
It's just that we began the process by getting together and writing songs together, and very quickly realised, you know what, we can do this with just the two of us.
Yeah.
We didn't sort of sit down and sort of hatch a plan or anything. And actually, I felt kind of the task of making a record quite daunting, because I felt like, okay, we've got two or three of songs out of this format, but I don't know if there's a record in what we have, you know.
Yeah.
It felt so limiting. There was a kind of staring at the mountain kind of feeling to it. But I think, like Ben was saying, because of the way we wrote the record, it was accumulating kind of, yeah, behind our own backs. And I think that took away a lot of those doubts I was having.
Yeah, it wasn't until, I think, we realised that we had to write two more songs to actually have a record that we, yeah, realised we had a record.
Yeah, yeah.
And songs that were good enough to all be together.
It was the first album I'd ever made.
Yeah.
You'd made albums in other bands and stuff.
Yeah.
I think that thing of like making an album is the first, when it's the first time you've done it, it seems, yeah, like it's this thing you talk about from the age of 13.
Yeah, yeah.
So when it's finally happening, you're, yeah, like, oh, wow, we're actually making a real record.
So when you had like the two songs to write, which were the last two that you came up with for the album?
That was the last two on the album.
Oh, yeah, okay.
10 Ton Skeleton and Better Strangers.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
So did you think, well, we've got this that sounds like this, we've got this, you know, we need two tracks that need to be like this?
We just carried on, I think.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Just carried on, yeah, like...
And compiled it later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's good. That... It's that I mean, we have every record, really. I think at that point in the process, when you just give it one last push writing, your teeth are at their sharpest.
Yeah.
And I think I'm not really a fan of sports, but you see it in sports as well. It's in the kind of final hours of things where you're so immersed in the process, you're actually at your best. So I think we've had great experiences in that 11th hour of making records where we kind of tend to pull rabbits out of hats.
I find that at the very end and at the very beginning, for me, usually works the best. Everything else in between is kind of like the desert.
There's a funny thing as well where you don't know where you are in the process when you're in the process, because you can only identify that in hindsight.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's so many false starts and false finish lines.
Yeah.
There's things where you go, this is the first song of the record, and then 3 months later you've discarded that because you've gone on a completely different journey.
Yeah.
So it's only really when you look back that you know where you are. But just from our experience, we get to what we think is the end, and then we go, you know what, let's just book a studio session and let's go back in one more time and just...
It's an amazing thing making a record.
It is, yeah.
For me, I still reckon that the first one's, the best. Or the best experience. Not the best in sound, because, definitely bettered that now, but, it's a hard thing to beat, really.
Yeah, you're brilliantly naive.
Exactly. You don't know what you're doing, but in the best way.
Yeah, and I think you're at your most kind of childish, and I think that's really where all creativity lives, really. It is sort of being ridiculous and being playful, you know? And I think that's the one thing you spend probably the rest of your career trying to hold on to, that feeling. I think it was Picasso said that he'd spent his entire lifetime learning how to paint like a child, and it's that same feeling.
You need to
walk into the studio and just sort of be absurd.
I mean, I don't know whether it's the same for you, but to forget how you've done things in the past is I think it's a real good thing as well.
Yeah. I think what we do is kind of the opposite. We remember what we do in the past and don't repeat it.
Right. Yeah, so you're just always looking to do something different. Yeah.
So the with the first record, it was like, this is going to be bass guitar, drums, and vocals. That's it.
Yeah.
And then the second one, we introduced other things and just even writing songs differently. You never want to repeat yourself, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's being aware of, that one actually sounds a little bit like how we did this one. How can we do it differently?
Back to the record. Here's the penultimate track from the album, 10 Ton Skeleton. That was 10 Ton Skeleton by Royal Blood. I mean, can you look back at it now and sort of like think, okay, yeah, we had this idea. It was really successful and, we did what we set out to do. I guess now you can look back at it, either critically or without any criticism,
I think there's a weird, anti-climax getting at the end of anything, whether you're running a marathon or the end of a long ongoing thing, where there's a kind of bittersweet feeling to it, where the process is kind of over.
Yeah, the process can be agonizing though, can't it?
It definitely wasn't agonizing. I think there was just a big unknown.
Yeah,
because we did all our high fiving at Rockfield, listening back, and this is great. But there wasn't any expectations placed upon it. We had no...
But that changes everything, doesn't
it?
Yeah,
we just thought, this will be good to put on in our mate's car.
Yeah.
And show some
cousins
at Christmas. I don't know. It wasn't like...
It was mainly so we could play gigs.
Yeah, it was like, well, now we can play a show.
But that's my thing. It's like the success of it changes everything. and how we look at it. But I mean, do you sort of see through what it achieved? I mean, obviously it did exactly what you wanted it to do and more.
Yeah.
But does it change the way that you see it now as, you know?
Yeah. We thought we were getting a chocolate bar, and we got a golden ticket in there, and we were like, holy shit.
Definitely.
It launched us into the kind of stratosphere, and we got to go and have these, you know, unbelievable, extremely rarefied experiences
yeah.
And, and it's the reason I think... It is the reason we're here talking to you right now.
it's amazing.
It's a fact.
The life cycle of this record is nowhere near done. You know, it's like just keeps going. And
yeah, we're super proud of it. I mean, it's amazing, really, that you know, a lot of songs on that album are a part of our live show, we don't feel like. We're not like cringing at any of it, you know.
I think that's
something we're really stoked about, you know, because, and I'm almost grateful, you know, we kind of had that experience at the age we were at, because I feel like 3 years before that, I would have been cringing so hard. If we were going out and playing songs we'd written then, you know.
It's funny, isn't it?
I think any earlier, I would have been like, oh man, like, I'm 34 and having to play this, right? I mean, but I don't feel like that when we're playing anything off this record, which is a good feeling.
So you got 10 Ton Skeleton and Better Strangers, the last two tracks that you wrote for this album. You know, had you not done these last two tracks, you know, it might not have been the same record. Obviously wouldn't have been the same record.
Yeah.
Obviously you wrote them quite close together. Did you record them quite well, you know?
We recorded...
What's the question? I don't know.
We recorded them at Rack in London.
Rack Studio 3.
Yeah. I think we wrote Better Strangers on the road in Australia. Remember that?
Fantastic.
And 10 Ton, we had the chorus for 10 Ton Skeleton.
Yeah.
That was born out of, I saw St. Vincent play on Jules Holland.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw she had this like whammy pedal. It wasn't a whammy pedal. It's like a blue kind of Boss pedal where it does the whammy thing when you put your foot on it. So I bought one of those, and that's kind of the whole chorus part. I'm like laboring this pedal the whole way through, and that's kind of how we kind of landed on that. But we didn't have a verse for a long time, and then it turned out that the answer to the verse was just keep playing the same chords that were in the chorus. But it took months to kind of figure out.
We had a verse that was double the speed of the verse now.
Oh yeah, that was so bad.
Yeah, I think we took it. We're like, right. We showed it to a load of people, and I think it's Phil Christie was like, I'm not sure about the verse of this one. So,
yeah.
Yeah, we changed it.
But yeah, that was it, really. I think, was it like near Glastonbury when we finished? Yeah, we went to Rack. We did the last two songs, and then we went to Glastonbury.
Mm.
Nice.
Which would have been, what, 2013? Monkees were headlining.
Monkees, yeah. 13.
And that was it. That was cool, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Went to Glastonbury, we were like, just made an album.
Brilliant. And then was the artwork done at this point, or was this something that...
I think I can't remember the timeline of that, no.
But yeah, our manager Ian found Dan Hillier's page, basically.
Uh-huh.
And he saw this bit of art and showed us it to see what we thought, and... We loved it.
I think at the beginning we got him, we commissioned a few things.
Yeah.
But I think we had just fallen in love with the cover, what is now the cover.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, that feeling of like, oh my God, that the sound of your record is like staring back at you, isn't it?
Yeah.
We have to work out how to have this as the thing. And
Yeah.
His work really, really served us, you know. We were super lucky that he was involved, you know, because I think much like the making of the record, we sort of accidentally kind of stumbled across him, and he was, yeah.
That's good way of doing
it. We're very grateful for him.
Here's the 10th and final song from your debut. It's Better Strangers.
Alone in the valley, so hollow, hollow.
Set of Strangers, the final track from Royal Blood's first album. Mike, Ben, finally, how did you go about compiling the record, the closing track? You know, I know you said it was like the last one that you did, but I mean...
Yeah, there was probably, we're probably slightly biased in the last thing we recorded being the last thing, but yeah. I'm not very good at, even now when we're putting records together, Ben's pretty good at it.
Yeah?
Yeah. I like seeing the flow of things.
Yeah, it's a skill.
Yeah.
Ben's a good, Ben likes to DJ on the bus, so he knows how to compile a good playlist.
I think it's, you've got to be open to being out of your comfort zone with it a little bit as well and having other people's opinions and ideas.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And then, but I think it's always in your gut where you know where things should just about go.
Yeah. Yeah, if not the end, very close to the end.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like in that process of compiling, you actually realise whether you're done or not.
Ah, that's good.
I feel like that in past experiences where we're like, we're done, and then we what order should we put these songs in? And then you're like, something isn't...
Yeah, something's missing.
There's a reason this isn't flowing. Because everything is terrible.
And we were coming out of an era... We were just right at the cusp of coming out of an era of the first 30 seconds of the first three tracks on, like, iTunes was all you could hear. Mm-hmm. So people would always put the best three songs...
Right.
One, two, and three. Because that's what's going to sell your record. But we were just on the cusp of coming out of that era. But I think that was still in your mind when you've got Out of the Black, Coming Over, and Figure It Out, which were all singles.
Yeah.
So you saw the landscape and you adjusted.
Yeah.
Smart.
Before I let you go, I've been asked to ask you why Hole didn't make the album.
I think, again, Hole is such a... It felt like the start of something.
Yeah.
And I feel that we already had the start of it with Out of the Black. I felt that that song just felt...
Yeah. So it was a consideration. It did cross your mind, yeah.
I think even we feel that now with when we play the set, you know, when we play live. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's either one or the other.
Right.
I think as well, there's always a point when you're compiling a record where it's really about the sum of its parts, you know, rather than there might be great songs that don't make it onto the record, but it's about how they work together. And I think the track listing we arrived at, it felt like such a concise, it felt like a sort of fist with a ribbon on it. It felt so punchy and mm-hmm. so as one.
Yeah.
That even though we love Hole, we still play Hole live sometimes, you know, and even now I would argue, where would you put it on the record?
Yeah.
And make it flow as well.
Yeah.
You know?
Also, it's just a great song to have as a B-side.
It's not like we burnt the song as well, and it's out there, and it's still a part of the band and what we do live, so...
Okay, well, Mike, Ben, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
The listening party. And, thanks for doing the Twitter ones as well.
That was great.
That's a classic from Royal Blood, concluding this listening part in Absolute Radio. Thank you to Mike Kerr and Ben Thatcher for taking me through their debut album on its 10th anniversary. Don't forget, you can hear the special anniversary edition of the album with extra tracks right now. If you've heard the show before, you'll know I like to end each episode by telling you what I've been listening to recently. So, I've just got back from Kendall Corlin, and I sang with some heroes of mine, Certain Ratio. And I'd like to suggest that we listen to the album Good Together. Your Blue Eyes is an amazing opener. And also, you know, Good Together, the track I sang on, is a banger as well. But anyway, any of their albums is good. Also, I've been listening to The Libertines because I had to brush up on my lyrical knowledge for Don't Look Back Into the Sun, which of course I knew. But, you know, you have to brush up on these things. I had a little rehearsal. Before I did it. So Let's go with Don't Look Back Into the Sun, or Up the Bracket, or Libertines. They were my favourites anyway. The new album's good too, as you obviously know, because we did a listening party on Absolute Radio. Also, I've been listening to Geneva Jacuzzi, who has made a few records, and I've always really liked her. But she's got a new song out called Scene Ballerina, which is absolutely fantastic. Really great chorus. Can I mention the new Chris Cohen album? It's really beautiful, and been a big fan for a long time. His album's called Paint a Room. I really would recommend the track Night or Day. Damage is also fantastic, but the whole album's well worth a listen. And while we're talking about recommendations, why don't you recommend this show to a friend? Tell them to replay any previous listening party by just searching and following Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. There you'll find a whole archive of listening parties with the likes of Tears for Fears going through The Hurting. They talk about their favourite covers of Mad World. There's also Def Leppard discussing how they took some of the most iconic classic rock songs ever recorded and turned them into orchestral pieces. And there's also me speaking about the process behind the Charlatans record, telling stories. Every song in this episode of my listening party was taken from Royal Blood's self-titled debut. All tracks are written by Royal Blood. The album was released on Warner Brothers in August 2014. See you next time.
This is Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.